17 of the stage three hearings. We have the street development team, Mr. Street, I presume?
Yes.
And Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm. You're very welcome. You have the floor. Tell us what you would like to tell us.
Okay. I'm going to keep it simple today. I'm going to make 4 points. The first point is about the map here. Historical development patterns in Lake Harwood. The development, Lake Harwood started by being developed here, it spread along the lake, and then you get the Timsfield and the Grandview subdivisions. Street development has been involved in developing this area over the years. And we submit that the town can't go up the lake, can't go this way, can't go that way. So if you do need extension, continuing this pattern sort of left to right of the development is logical. The second point I'd like to make is in our submission in paragraph 6 about the Section 32 report, in particular the ME consulting report. The report states that it doesn't look at the economics of whether you can further subdivide the existing township lots down. And then the report goes on ad nauseum for 400 pages. And we submit that it's a fundamental thing. I've spoken with our surveyors about this. Talk to any professional person. Your typical 800 square metre lot at Harwear doesn't work to chop at the house position and so on. We submit that report is completely faulty on the assumptions it makes about how many houses are going to be created within the township. That's my second point finished. My third point is our company's own plans. We submitted a plan to redevelop this block here.
So you designed the 1 acre lot subdivision to be readily able to be down to
the engineering. We've done a curve and channel. Mm. We could have done water tables and so on.
Is that domain estate?
Domain estate.
Yeah.
And also we've had, in addition to the council not extending our current consent, giving us adequate time on it. You know, we're having difficulties, like our last engineering consent took 10 months to get, you know, with the council, and we've just been through a sort of a four-month process from when your contractor finishes the works to getting signed off, and, you know, it's don't want to get sort of into any more of that, really. And my fourth point I'd like to make is that we submit that Willow Ridge's submission is a trade competition submission. The submission fails to state that they are a trade competitor, and we submit that a company doesn't have they claim they've got their company's amenity values. We claim companies don't have amenity values. So, we seek that submission to be struck out, and thus ends our 10 minutes, I hope. We're on time. Any questions?
First question is, I haven't looked it up, is Willow Ridge a further submission?
Yes, it is.
We've had this issue before. Somebody else has raised trade competition by a further submitter, and when I looked it up, I found that curiously, further submitters don't need to declare their trade competition status and don't need and aren't subject to the same requirements not to make trade competition further submissions. But the fact that it's a trade competition submission does go to the weight with which one considers.
I did check the form actually, and you're right. The further submission form doesn't have a
Yes, that was there.
But once one goes to the Environment Court, I think.
Yeah, that's right. You can't lodge an appeal in the Environment Court without making a trade competition declaration. In effect, demonstrating that you would not make a trade competition appeal.
And to not do so would be a prosecutable offence.
Well, I think that the end result would be your appeal would be struck out.
Yeah.
So just to get clear, you said you've already completed the first stage of one acre lots.
Yep. And we've got the engineering, we're just about. And our surveyors have got the engineering ready to lodge for the next stage.
Well, we went to have a look, and it's obvious that the roads are all done.
Yeah.
Mm. And you can see the layout of the sections, so we know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And the section 42 report, I think it is, said that everyone, that it was the community was unanimous about they didn't want any development south of Cemetery Road, but I would say that everyone who owns the land south of Cemetery Road unanimously would like to get it rezoned. So I don't know anybody who's south of Cemetery Road, a landowner who's against rezoning. And certainly all of the purchasers purchased their initial blocks want to.
What's the current zoning?
The current zoning is rural residential, and the proposed zoning is rural residential as well.
Not rural lifestyle, it's rural residential.
Rural residential, yes.
Which is why they're 1 acre lots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I should say 4,000, but an acre is 4,024 square metres.
Can I ask Mr. Shute a question?
Absolutely.
A question from me. Are you lined up with Universal Developments in the sense that they've asked for, the whole area, the south of Cemetery Road, to go to a settlement zone or some other form of zoning, plus the industrial? Or are you looking at having if the recommendation was Universal was too much, but you're saying that your site should still be settlement zone, or do you kind of rise and fall with Universal, in your view?
I think we're different because the land that we've got there, it's been zoned for development since the 80s plan. So it's been zoned for development for 40 years where we are, so it's a quite different situation. We haven't opposed anything that Universal Developments has done to date. We weren't in opposition to anything that they've done. We don't get into that really. And as far as the urban boundary goes, we made a submission. We actually already have this matter under appeal, so it's mentioned in our submission, but from stage one, the urban growth boundary went. And it's worth noting that the Hawea Community Association, in their initial submission, supported our land being part of the township zone. But then when Universal came along, they decided, let's just try and stop everything, south of Cemetery Road. And I think it's kind of strange you've got an urban growth boundary at the moment drawn north of a special housing area and north of where our property is. It doesn't make sense.
You've got that map in your submission. You've got that map in your submission. Thank you. That's clear to me. Thank you very much.
Just a couple. One is Universal presented yesterday and they talked about a 15-metre setback or a building restriction area that extends from their property up to Cemetery and Domain, the intersection, which included your property. That's something that you've agreed with them?
I'm not quite sure what you're talking about. There's existing covenants on our land to protect views over
the Universal. I mean, your land stops here.
Yep.
And Universal presented yesterday, and they were talking about an area here.
Yep.
And it had a 15-metre setback that went all the way up here to this intersection. So obviously that's on your boundary.
Yeah. One thing I'll say there, Domain Road, adjacent to our property, is actually 50 metres wide. It's wider than a normal road. And that reason for that is because it was laid out for a railway line. So there is there's a bit of extra dirt floating around there.
Oh, there you go.
And I think that might be what it is, because Domain Road is 50 metres wide.
On the original, the concept plan that they came up with, there was a 5 metre setback that extended up there, and they were talking yesterday about a 15 metre setback that extended all there.
We'll put it another way. What is your view of the 15 metre setback on your land on the Domain Road frontage?
Well, it would be inconvenient just where we're doing these sections up so long here, I guess.
Yes.
Because you've already subdivided those.
Well, they're consented, yeah.
Yeah, you've got consent.
But there's 1 acre lots, though.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But you can actually see the main road here is 50 metres wide there, and then it clicks in there again to the 25. So it's actually almost here. It's almost 50 metres wide all the way along there anyway. Yeah. So you've already got your setback, I think.
And thank you for that.
So your message to us is that's news to you. The whole concept of a setback along to the main road is news to you.
Yeah, we haven't promoted that.
To me, it seems like if the whole subdivision was planned for smaller sections, then you could allow for more setback.
That is the basis for this setback requirement.
Yeah. So if the lot size changed,
it could possibly be accommodated.
Yeah.
And one final for me is we've heard a lot of evidence about the Gladstone Gap and natural hazard and et cetera, et cetera. But the Gladstone Gap went from a 1 in 500 year event to a 1 in 1,000 year event. We've heard lots of evidence about whether it is or isn't a hazard.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't you go east? Why wouldn't you jump the Gladstone Gap and head to John Creek? And why isn't that, in your opinion,
The eastern edge of the township is sort of rural at the moment, and I think this pattern of sort of left to right in the Harwea Township, it's sort of logical the way that would go through there.
Okay. That's all for me, sir.
Can I just follow on from the questions about relate to in relation to the universal proposal. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've come in with a structure plan, I suppose, for that whole area, your land, the people between you and the main road, and various conditions relating to servicing, water supplies, sewage, roading, etc. I mean, are you familiar with where they've got to in terms of presenting proposals that relate to your land?
I've got to confess, I haven't. I've seen their structure plan. They've got an educational facility next to us.
Yeah. If the overall zoning was agreed and went through the process, would you still develop your land separately, re-subdivide and subdivide down to smaller lots, or do you see yourselves being part of the overall? Development.
It might be possible to perhaps do, to redevelop. We're doing the next stage now, but it might be possible to do some at the bottom there. But at that point, I don't know.
All right.
The problem is these processes are so long. I mean, don't forget how long it is since we've made our stage one submission. On this, just absolute years and years elapse, and now I'm starting to realise it takes 2 years to get a title, even from when you've got your consent. So
there's a lot of water to go under the bridge here.
My hair is already grey. I don't know. It might be too long for me.
I was youthful when we started this. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to you both. Appreciate your input.
Yep.
Thank you for coming over, and we'll see you next week, but in a different capacity.
Yes. Helicopters.
Thank you.
Right, thank you.
Thanks.
the Corporate Estate Limited Partnership team, getting comfortable for the for a stint for the rest of the day. Sarah.
Yes, thank you. So, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Bridget Evans. I'm Councel for Corbridge. So I'm Councel for Corbridge, Bridget Irving. To my right, I have Jason Watkins at the moment, who has also filed a brief of evidence. We've obviously got a number of witnesses today that will be joining us via Zoom, and my intention at this point was to call them after the breaks so that we can get them online, which just may mean we need to adapt our running order a little bit if necessary as the day proceeds, if that works for you, Commissioner.
Absolutely. As I say, we've got the rest of the day. As far as I'm concerned, while it would be logical to hear the planners last,
yes.
Because we can ask the questions arising out of the answers we get from the other experts, how you order the rest of your team and how you accommodate people coming in by Zoom is entirely over you.
Great.
And if it makes sense, because I understand that if it makes sense to break the witness to accommodate somebody who you pre-arranged at a particular time, we're flexible about that too.
Okay.
So, as I say, the day is yours.
Fabulous. Thank you. So I obviously filed opening legal submissions on Friday. I wasn't intending on taking you through those at all, so would start with any questions that you may have arising from those before Mr. Watkins would be called. You will recall that I requested an opportunity for Mr. Marshall to make a presentation. He has asked that he be given the opportunity to do that after the morning tea break. So if that is okay with you, I would like to call him then.
That's fine. As I said, you got my message.
I did.
It's up to you to restrain his enthusiasm and to haul him out of the witness box after 10 minutes.
Yes.
Having met Mr. Marshall on the site visit, that may be a challenging task, but I'm relying on you for that.
Indeed. No, we're prepared for that.
And we have read your legal submissions. Happy for you, just if you either to give us any highlights or just to take questions, but whatever suits you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm happy just to take questions. I think, I'm focused on what I consider the key issues to be. There was a fair bit of agreement, I think, between myself and Council for Council on some of the issues around scope and so on. So I've really just focused on what I think were the key themes or questions that I thought you may have in relation to the Corbridge rezoning proposal. So I'm happy just to start with questions.
Well, let's start then with the relevance of the existing 35 lot resource consent. Like, I was left a little puzzled because I looked at the map. It does not appear that Corbridge is planning to build its residential lots in accordance with the consented locations and building platforms. Is that right?
If the site is rezoned, that's correct. The point of, or my reference to the existing consent, mm-hmm. is really to consider it as an alternative if the rezoning proposal was not successful. So that would be the outcome that you would see if the site's to remain zoned rural. But you're right that if the rezoning proposal goes through, that existing resource consent, you wouldn't see the building locations that were approved during that consent. And particularly, I think the platforms that are located along the escarpment. That's been reconfigured somewhat through the structure plan.
And then I would, like, based on that understanding, I was left a little puzzled about that your response to Ms. Scott's analysis of whether the scope to for residential lots to be permitted was to point to the rules that say you can develop lots on existing consented building platforms as a permitted activity.
Yes.
But that's not what you're proposing to do. So what does that mean in terms of the your response to Ms. Scott's argument?
Yes. Yeah, well, I think, I mean, as I had understood Ms. Scott's argument, it was that your scope to grant relief is between what is in the rural zone and what has been asked for through submission. And so I was making the point that there is a rule within the rural zone that makes residential activity or construction of residential units a permitted activity. And so my submission to you is that there is scope for some residential units to be permitted within the rural visitor zone because it is permitted within the existing rural zone.
But I suppose the bit that I don't understand is how that assists Corbridge, given that you're not proposing to put residential units where they're consented, you're proposing to put them somewhere else.
Well, but I think the rule applies if you had consented a new building platform. It doesn't rely simply on existing building platforms by consent. You can also have a new building platform identified. So what I'm saying is that the rural zone rules include some permitted activities for the establishment of residential units, and so I'm telling, or my submission to you, is that there is scope to provide for that in the rural visitor zone.
So it's not so much the existing consent, it's the theoretical ability to do that on a permitted basis.
Correct.
That you're relying on.
Correct.
But there is no consent other than the existing consent.
Correct.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Currently.
And am I right thinking that you're relying on this in terms of scope for allowing residential activity in this zone, a request to? But that's a different question to the existing environment.
That's
question.
Right, yes. Mm.
So are you relying on it for the existing environment as well as for scope?
Or just the existing consent?
Yes.
Well, I think, as I say, for the purposes of... I agree with the submissions I think were made by Ms. Scott around the relevance of the existing environment. It's a discretionary matter for you. I think in this case, the existing consent is part of the environment or the outcome that you will see if the site is to remain zoned rural. And so it's a point of comparison for assessing which outcome best achieves the objectives and policies that you need to consider.
So you're relying on it more on a Section 32 basis,
yes,
than then the classic existing environment is that because this is consented, the plan ought to provide for this plus a bit more.
Correct.
your paragraph 19 was there. First of all, can you explain how, it, like, you're making two propositions here. First, to provide for that you need specific provision for commercial, recreation and tourism related activities in rural areas, and the second is that policy 6313 contemplates that, as contemplates a separate regulatory regime. Now I want to ask you about both of those propositions. Mm-hmm. So just take the first one. In essence, doesn't the rural zone already provide for commercial, recreation, tourism-related activities? It certainly has a consenting pathway for them.
It does, of a reasonably limited scale.
Not for visitor accommodation.
Well, I think, I mean, it does when you look at the combination of the rules, I think, and the controls around things like buildings and so on. So you've got the activity itself may be provided for, but then the question of how much of that you may be able to construct is quite significantly constrained by the rules around buildings. And I think where I see the 6.3.1.3 dovetailing with those strategic objectives and policies is to say that where we are looking to develop a sort of, I suppose, an overall project or something more than just, say, a couple of cabins out the back of a high country station or something, that we should be doing that through zone provisions that specifically address the particular issues or activities that we are trying to manage, rather than dealing with it on an ad hoc basis through resource consent. So I think the plan in that sense has tried to be quite deliberate, that we want to avoid that ad hoc consenting type regime by having zones in place to facilitate those activities, particularly where they are somewhat more significant.
Chapter 6 says that expressly in relation to rural lifestyle and rural living. There's a policy that says specifically to prefer that areas of, I'll call them globally rural living,
yes,
be zoned. But it doesn't say that for others. And the reason I was going to ask you about how you draw the proposition you draw from 6313 is that it's framed as an acknowledgement that some things are separate and have their own regime. It doesn't say to me it's like an acknowledgement of what was already there, rather than looking prospectively at how a new proposal should be addressed in the plan. So, tell me why you draw that inference.
Mm. Well, I suppose I might answer that with a question, is how does the plan provide for visitor activities and tourism-related activities if it is not through zoning and, to some extent, rules within the zones? And so clearly the council have taken the view that with at least some rural visitor activities, there should be zones. That's why we have a rural visitor zone. And so I think that that is an acknowledgement of that direction in 6313. And rather than building, I suppose, suppose, the plan from the bottom, which is to say we've got these tourist activities and we want to cover them off. I've come at it from a strategic objectives and policies of saying we need to be providing for these activities. We've got a provision within 6313 that says we should have separate zones. We've now got a rural visitor zone. So that's the perspective end of the spectrum, not just simply a case of establishing zones for activities that we already have.
Well, the answer to that might be, at least as regards the rural visitor zone, that it's as notified, it started life as something that was happening in on discrete sites in O&Ls that are, quote, remote, unquote. We've had a lot of discussion with various parties as to how remote is remote and how do you test it, but just put that aside for the moment. But if you just focus on the start, the fact that it was notified in O&Ls and the clearly the rules around O&Ls are much more, much less inviting for development of all kinds for obvious reasons, and hence the need to carve out an exception zone. But this comes back to where we started. Is the same the case in RCLs?
Well, I think it is. If the objectives and policies around the provision of visitor activities are to be implemented effectively.
So, I mean, how do you read what you're saying that in order to implement these policies, they must be done through separate zones? How do you read that into 331A and 6313?
Well, I think, so 331A is the provide for those activities.
Yes.
And then if we look at 6313, it's provide a separate regulatory regime
for those
Gibson
zones.
Gibson Valley and
so on. It doesn't say provide a separate regulatory regime for visitor accommodation and visitor activities. It just says provide them for those zones.
Well, including the special zone, of which the RVZ is one.
Yes, but it doesn't say you must provide for visitor accommodation and visitor activities in those zones, only in those zones.
No, I think that's right. I accept that. But I think there's a point at which dealing with things simply on a consent-by-consent basis isn't the most effective regulatory regime for managing activities in a particular location. And I think what we're saying here with the Corbridge site is that we've got, or proposing, a integrated development, and to do that on an ad hoc basis, consent by consent, wouldn't be an efficient or effective way of achieving the objectives and policies.
Yeah, but that's not, your submissions go further than that. They say that 331A is to be primarily provided through zones, and that 6313 contemplates a separate regulatory regime for commercial tourism and recreation activities as opposed to zones. So rather than it just being a weighing up of alternative ways of doing it, in some instances the rural zone would be fine, in some instances a separate zone may be more appropriate.
And I think that has to be looked at or considered depending on, I suppose, the nature and scale of what you're proposing. And so in this instance with Corbridge and rural visitor zones, I suppose more generally, is it's considered that a zone is a more effective way of implementing the objectives and policies.
Because if I took your written submissions literally, I was reading it as you were saying that every visitor accommodation and every recreation activity in the rural areas should be zoned.
Yeah, no, that's not what I intended to say, no.
Because then, you know, it sort of undermines the fact that there is a consenting regime in
yes.
the rural zone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just continuing that theme slightly, this is paragraph 20, and it's probably the same question but in a different way. But unfortunately, the notified provisions do not fully implement the strategic provisions of the discussion we've been having. What's the legal position in terms of, you know, clearly the council in section 32 has looked at the zone, it's talked about what it is, it's O&Ls, it's small, it's discreet, says it's based on some of the previous zones, but also talks about a first-base principle, and has done it in quite a discreet way. And I read your legal submissions to almost say that, and this is the question, tell me if I'm wrong, is that the zone in itself, because of the way it's notified, has not given effect to the strategic directions. And the question I have, is it done by a zone, individual zone basis, or is it the collective district plan that needs to give effect to that, and therefore the rural visitor zone is notified, Ms Grace is to expand that somewhat on new section 42, but as notified, is to deal discreetly with small, remote O&Ls, and there are other provisions in the plan which deal with the things we're talking about. And in fact, you talk about Corbridge fits the definition of resort, and there's a resort zone, and therefore, I suppose, could I pose the question, why wasn't a resort zone sought either through this process or a private plan change?
Yeah. So there's a few parts to that question.
Okay.
I think that when I went back to the Section 32 report, it struck me that the development of the zone provisions had focused very much on the existing areas. And to me, that isn't how a zone should be developed. We should be looking at what are we trying to achieve in terms of our higher order provisions, and then casting the net more broadly than simply some discrete areas, particularly when you're going to be developing a general zone as opposed to site-specific zones like Millbrook or Jack's Point, for example.
You're referring to, sorry, when you say a general zone, are you referring
yep.
to the rural visitor zone as a general zone as opposed to an exception zone?
Well, I mean as a zone that applies to a whole lot of different sites. So rather than being a site-specific zone, it is a set of provisions that currently will apply to multiple different sites, unlike the resort zones that we see in the plan currently, which are specific to individual resorts. So that, in part, is the answer to that last
okay.
question, which is why didn't we seek a resort zone? Well, the resort zones are discrete, and so we'd need to have developed
right.
an entirely new zone, and we didn't haven't had an opportunity to do that through the district plan review process so far. In terms of plan changes, obviously, because of where the district plan process is currently, we can't initiate one yet.
To you. Right.
And we felt when the rural visitor zone provisions were notified that the Corbridge proposal was a fit, save for the fact the zone didn't specifically deal with rural character landscapes. When we read the provisions of the RVZ closely, it seemed, for lack of a better word, a little schizophrenic, in that it purports to apply to ONLs, but the language that's used in a lot of the provisions is the language that would apply to rural character landscapes. And so again, when you went back up to the higher order provisions, which talked about providing for these types of activities, it was in both ONLs and RVZs. And so, rural character landscapes, sorry. And so we thought it appropriate that when you're having a general zone or a zone that is to apply across the district, that that zone should at very least look at sites within the different landscape classifications. Because there was recognised, I suppose, demand for the need to provide for rural visitor activities, and it seemed to us that there could have been, at the very least, or should have been, some new sites contemplated through the RVZ zone.
Can I just ask you a follow-up question to that? So the council have clearly identified what appears to be relatively narrow RVZ. You're seeking in your submissions and in terms of your client that it should apply much more broadly, rural character zones, this whole issue of remoteness. Is it your view in Section 32 terms that if the council was to have done a broader job, I suppose using your terms, that it would need to then go and identify which sites would be suitable for an expanded rural visitor zone? Because the situation we now have is it's been notified there are a number, 14 I think, who are asking for the zone.
Mm.
So it's now looked at on an individual basis as opposed to under a broader Section 32 analysis and what's appropriate.
I mean, I think in a best case scenario, yes, the council would have undertaken an assessment of where it might be appropriate to provide for some new rural visitor zones when it developed the zone provisions. But I think I'd probably acknowledge that that can be challenging for the council, although they were aware of Corbridge's thinking at the time the zone provisions were being developed, and I suspect that wouldn't just be in relation to our site. I think that they could have gone through an exercise of identifying where it might be appropriate to have more provision for rural visitor activities when they did the development of their zone.
Thank you. Just to follow up, going back a step, said that Corbridge hasn't had the opportunity to, in the PDP review, to seek a resort zone.
Mm.
I was thinking, well, surely it could have done that when the land was notified as rural in stage one?
Well, I think the message that we received at that stage was that we couldn't seek zones that weren't included within stage one. Although I think Dan Curley might be better to answer that question because I wasn't involved with the project as early as that. But certainly, I think that, and I might actually leave that question to Dan because I'm just not quite 100% sure of the timing of some of the discussions.
Because the emails that are attached to someone's evidence relate more to could we ask for the old RV zone to be applied at, maybe it's not even other people.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not
even
your
evidence. Yeah, I think the question would be better directed elsewhere, because I'm not familiar enough with the timelines, I'm sorry.
And the other point is that in terms of a private plan change as an option, my understanding is you can't apply for a private plan change when a district plan is under review. Is that what you mean?
Correct, yes.
And
because only councils can make a variation.
You can apply, but they may not accept it.
No,
it's not that you can't apply.
For variations, it's only the council. And because we've got a proposed plan, we'd need to seek to vary that, so it would have to be in a council initiated process. And then, of course, we've got the stand down once the provisions become operative, which means we'd have to wait a few years.
Thinking, given although this process is referred to as a review, the Environment Court has clear that what it is actually doing is making a series of plan changes to the ODP.
Mm.
So do those bars still apply?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the challenge that we have, we thought through this quite a lot initially, is that our site's being rezoned through stage one, or considered through stage one, and so we don't have a sort of operative plan that we could seek to initiate a plan change in relation to. So it's just a really awkward part of the process because of the way that the plan review process has played out.
Okay. So I think I'd write on my note, yes in theory, but not in practice.
Yes, I think that's right.
What is the current state of the play with the appeals on the rural zone?
From memory, there have been at least some mediations take place in relation to the rural zone. A good portion of it, I believe, is now operative, but I think there are still appeals to be resolved on some matters and also in relation to some of the objectives and policies. But it's very challenging to keep exactly on top of where all of that is, I have to confess.
Yes, Ms. Scott has given us 900 pages of consent orders and consent memoranda that I have to confess that I have not attempted to get my head around just yet.
No, you can be forgiven for that.
Talked already about the differences in the elements of the RV zone, as you said. The way the purpose of the RV zone is described is of a small, discreet, difficult to see developments. Now, Mr. Espy will talk to us about how difficult it is or is not to see on this site, but the one thing this is not is small and discreet.
Well, I think it's discreet in the sense that it's a discreet site.
All right. If this is small, I'd be interested to know what your definition is.
I acknowledge that it's not small. I think you could say that of most golf courses. They're not by their nature constrained things.
And so the question in my mind is, in terms of plan drafting, the most appropriate course to redraft the RV zone to accommodate what you're seeking, which would mean that, and we've posed this question to others, it's hard to imagine, well, what wouldn't be suitable for an RV zone? Particularly in an RCL area, or to leave the RV zone as something same or similar to what it started out and look at your client's position as a discrete issue, zoning issue, that maybe the answer is a resort zone. Like you've developed the argument that it qualifies in terms of the definition, and you say it does. So what's your answer to that? That in terms of sitting, putting yourselves in our shoes, looking at, do we try and push the resort zone to something that it wasn't designed to be as notified? Leave us wondering about what are the implications of that for the rest of the district.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think you have essentially both options available to you. I think that there would be a pathway through for redrafting the existing zone to provide for development in RCLs, but I can also acknowledge the anxiousness that you have about that. I think that, I mean, in some ways we've tried to strike a bit of a balance in our own evidence by providing a site-specific suite of provisions in order to, limit the upset, if we call it that, of the notified provisions. So you may well have a single RVZ zone, but that it has different provisions that apply to RVZs within ONLs as compared to RCLs. Or, as you say, you may decide that you don't want to do that and that the preference would be to carve out Corbridge entirely. And I think Ms. Scott and I agreed that there is scope for you to do that if you were to choose or elect that was the most efficient and effective regime for you. I mean, I haven't sat through, the rest of the hearings, the extent you have, to know whether there are other requests for RVZ within the rural character landscapes, which might tend to suggest that having provisions within the RVZ zone that apply both to ONLs and RCLs would be more efficient. So I can't help you probably on that point. But I think you certainly have options available to you to manage, I think, all of those concerns.
I think one, there are other people seeking them. I mean, we've got 14 and everyone wants something different.
Yes.
Yeah. And they're in all sorts of scales and all sorts of activities. So everyone wants a bespoke, or virtually everyone wants a bespoke RVZ for their location. But in relation to the RCL particularly, but also opening up the RV zone from what it was possibly originally intended, so that it covers the RCL, it covers bigger proposals, it covers more diverse proposals, a wider range of activities, residential.
Yes.
So doing that generally as a pathway opens up a policy analysis for the rest of the district, which the individual submitters don't give us.
Yeah, I mean,
because that's not,
I suppose you've got to remember, I think is it 97% of the district is classified as outstanding natural landscape. So that issue probably already exists in relation to the RVZ,
if it is only
to apply in ONLs.
Well, it's also limited in scale and intensity and discrete and no residential, and all those things also constrain it, even in the ONL.
Yeah, and I suppose the question is with those things is how much does it constrain it? I mean, is scale a relative term? that might, you know, mean that if you've got a very, very large station, for example, that you could have, you know, in absolute terms, a large RVZ that isn't out of proportion in terms of scale with its overall site. So there's some real challenges with, I think, the way that that purpose has been drafted. And I'm not sure that opening the zone up to apply to RCLs creates a whole lot more issues than may already exist. Because you've got a relatively small area within the district that is rural character landscape.
Only small in proportion. It's not really small.
Yes.
I mean, if you take the Wokatit Basin, although it's got a separate zoning, and the whole of the Upper Clutha,
yeah.
I mean, that's not small. And, I mean, we've had witnesses say to us, you know, how many more, if you got rid of remote and got rid of scale and just said it has to be low landscape sensitivity, we've said, well, how many more locations are there like that in the RCL and, say, even in just in the Upper Clutha? And they all say lots.
Yes. Yeah, well, I think that's right. I mean...
So how do we deal with the the planning and the costs and benefits of that when we don't have evidence on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to... I think my answer to that is you've got to deal with what's in front of you. So you've currently got these 14, I think you see...
Oh, well, we actually haven't. We've got 14 plus the amendments to the general, to the zone.
Right, yes. So, but anyone who, so beyond those 14, if someone else wants to develop rural visitor activities, they'll need to seek a rezoning.
But that's not how you plan.
Isn't it? I mean,
you have to, you don't just plan about zonings, you plan about the provisions that lay the framework for that zoning.
Yes, and so when
and that's
someone
what
else
wanting to change.
Yeah, well, I suppose when someone else comes along and says, I want an RVZ, they will have to demonstrate that those provisions or what those provisions enable is appropriate for the site that they're dealing with.
But if those provisions enable huge developments easily in the RCL, then we have to look at the long-term implications, costs and benefits of readily enabling rural visitor accommodation proposals to be accepted into the future versus not readily enabling that if the zone is more constrained, because people are opening the door through the changes to the objectives and policies and rules, not just saying, well, we want another one of those RVs. They say we also want to make it open up the whole set of provisions so that it's easier for lots of people to want them in the future. So do we just ignore that and wait
for the
submissions?
I think the challenge with that is in figuring out how big a problem that is, because we don't know how many people might come to seek RVZ zones or what types of visitor activities they may contemplate. So it's really difficult, I think, for you to, I suppose, put your finger on that issue looking forward. I think for the purposes of this exercise, I think you do need to focus on the sites that are up for grabs now and people who seek to have their land rezoned to the zone in the future will need to do that cognizant of not just the provisions in the RVZ, but whether or not rezoning those sites to RVZ is going to implement those higher order provisions, particularly around things like landscape and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I can understand your anxiety about it, but I don't think it's sort of a bit of a rabbit hole almost to try and anticipate what might happen in the future in terms of those rezoning requests. I think you've got to leave that to people to consider when they actually see those proposals down the track.
Can I jump in? Because I don't want to be Alice looking down the rabbit hole. So clearly exploring that avenue gets us to the rabbit hole. But you mentioned the potential of carving out Corbridge entirely.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the pathway? What are the options from if we left the RVZ alone and said, well, this isn't for Corbridge?
Yeah.
What's the pathway there?
Well, I think there's sort of two pathways, if we call it that. One is to have a Corbridge RVZ that has specific provisions that help manage activity within the site, or
but that's
you could
a rabbit hole, so.
Well, no, I don't think it is, because it's not going to be a set of provisions that could apply to other sites in the future. So you wouldn't, I don't think, see someone asking to have Corbridge RVZ rules apply to another site.
Hogan's Gully.
Hogan's Gully.
Oh, sorry, that's it. Anyway, crack on.
Okay. So the other option would be to identify a separate zone entirely, whether it's a resort zone or you could just call it the Corbridge zone. I don't know if the name matters. That just applies to this site.
A Millbrook too.
Kind of. Yeah.
Mini Millbrook.
Yeah. Or
like yeah, I'm not suggesting before Mr. Marshall has apoplexy. I'm not suggesting that what his vision is the same as that of Millbrook, but in planning terms.
Mm. Yeah, and I think you know you could do
that mechanism.
And the scope for that is, however, as I think we've talked about already, sits between what is provided for in the rural zone provisions versus what has been sought through submissions. But it's a sort of form over function exercise, I think, to force you to work within the existing RVZ zone if you think that it would be more appropriate to set it out on its own.
Teetering on that rabbit hole again for a second, the is the avenue to, you mentioned prior about identifying potential sites within the Upper Clutha for an RVZ, is that the role of council, which you alluded possibly was, and B, is that the role of potentially the Upper Clutha land use study which has been proposed?
That might be something that sits within the terms of reference for that study. Although I think the court will be dictating that to an extent. But it may be that through that study, areas are identified that are more amenable to development than others, and then there may be consideration about what form of development would be most appropriate in those areas.
So with reflection on that, has that effect been achieved by the Wakatipu Basin Land Use Study?
I don't know, to be honest. I haven't looked into that in great detail. I don't have any clients that have asked me to, so I can't really comment on that for you. I'm sorry,
okay.
Commissioner.
Sorry, that was a bit of a sidetrack. Apologies. The other point in terms of the consequences of broadening the RV zone, step back as we started, that it was remote, whatever that means, remote, small, but one of the, and in our O&Ls, that one of the consequences of it being small or remote was that it provided for staff accommodation. And the reason provided for staff accommodation is that if it's small and remote, then it's not sensible to contemplate staff travelling to the site and home again. They need to be accommodated on site.
Mm-hmm.
If it ceases to be remote, ceases to be in O&Ls, does that open up the
question as to whether staff accommodation on site is appropriate, given all of the things that the plan has to say about urban development being within urban areas, rural living being provided for in RL and RR zones.
Yeah. I suppose our view, or Corbridge's view, is that with developments of the nature of Corbridge, it is desirable, appropriate, and possibly necessary to provide for your workers. One of the, I suppose, perennial challenges I think that Queenstown has faced is how to house its workers. And
can
we
just say Queenstown Lakes?
Or Queenstown Lakes, sorry. And the challenges that that has presented, I think, for everybody. I think we probably all have seen some of the examples of, you know, really quite appalling conditions that workers have had to live in this district. So I don't think that that is simply a consequence of visitor activities being provided for in remote areas. It's a challenge that arises across the district, and in Corbridge's case, they've sought to try and address it specifically by providing, as part of its development, for worker accommodation, so that it can provide, you know, a much higher quality living environment for the people that work on site, and that's partly to ensure that they can get good staff, keep good staff. I think that the fact that resort has been carved out of the definition of urban development is perhaps also a nod to that issue. And that those developments are fully integrated developments that take account of the sort of wider range of activities and so on that occur within those types of developments.
With the worker accommodation, given the wider policy direction about having your residential activities, your commercial activities, your community activities in towns, what's the policy basis for having worker accommodation in a non-remote site like Corbridge on site as opposed to in a town? That same accommodation could perhaps be developed in a town.
Potentially it could. I think we're not seeing that, and I don't know if I could, whether that's a consequence of planning settings for the residential zones in terms of what that means in terms of people's ability to afford to build and live in those environments in places like Wanaka, which are in such high demand. So whilst I acknowledge that as a general proposition, the plan wants people to live in towns, but I think when you are creating a development like Corbridge that is going to generate reasonably significant number of jobs, and we know that it is difficult for people in the visitor industry at times to find good quality accommodation, that it is appropriate to address that issue as part of this development.
Sort of scale, proximity, the scale of the development, having the worker accommodation in close proximity on the same site, managed under the same ownership.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that and Jason, I think, will speak to this more, that allows Corbridge to, I suppose, in essence, subsidise the accommodation of its workers and provide them with a much better living environment than the standard planning regime can.
Can I just quickly ask a clarification about the workers' accommodation? In the various evidence, there are all sorts of numbers put around for the numbers of workers' accommodation units, or whatever they're called. But am I right in thinking that you've landed on 100?
We've landed on 100 as the sort of, I suppose, permitted number. And you will see in the rule framework that we could apply for consent for more. And also there's a more restrictive regime if any of that accommodation was to provide for off-site workers. So there's sort of a starting point of 100 units for on-site staff. I think from memory it's restrictive discretionary if we need more units for on-site staff, and then a non-complying consent requirement if there were to be off-site workers accommodated. So essentially the first 100 we think is going to be adequate for the scale of the development that we're proposing. We may need more, and that would be a consent. Mm.
And the definition is for, well, if there's a definition or the requirement, is that those people work within the zone.
Yes.
Can I just follow up with another question about that? In your discussion about scope, I think it is,
mm-hmm.
you say there is scope for these 100, maybe it's not in your discussion about scope.
No, I think you're right. I think
it's in paragraph 11.
Yes.
Yeah. You talk about the scope for residential
mm-hmm.
activities.
Yes.
And you talk about, in relation to the worker accommodation, you refer to rule, one of the rules.
46.43.
The permitted activity rule, yes, that permits commercial recreation activities.
Including on-site staff accommodation.
Does it say including on-site? Is that the word that it uses? So I'm interested in commercial recreation activities and on-staff accommodation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one assumes that it's on-staff accommodation relating to commercial recreation activities, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the definition of visitor accommodation also includes on-site, so that sort of just comes with the definition.
Yes.
I'm interested to how you've expanded that to construction workers. Because they aren't really visitor accommodation staff or commercial recreation staff. They're staff that come in for a short period, maybe even a week,
mm-hmm.
And then go off and work on someone else's site.
Yes.
So in terms of your argument,
mm-hmm.
how have you wrapped in construction workers?
Well, I think it's really a practical matter. This development has to get built, and we're going to need staff in order to do that. And if, as a general proposition, we've accepted that we should be able to accommodate our staff in relation to the commercial recreation activities or the visitor accommodation activities, the effect of accommodating your construction staff strikes me as being the same.
But that is a somewhat different argument, isn't it, to saying that it's already allowed by those rules?
Well, I think,
it might be a good idea, it might have no different effects, but that, and it might be pragmatic, but is that the same as saying those rules allow for it?
For construction staff,
As part of the permitted activities in the zone?
Well, I think that it does. If we take, perhaps it's best to explain it by way of example, if you've got Walter Peak, for example, and they're wanting to build a new part of a wool shed or something as part of that visitor accommodate, that commercial recreation activity, and they take their construction staff out there and have them stay on site while they're doing the building, I don't see how that is any different from accommodating the staff that will be working in that facility once it's finished.
So you're saying that commercial recreation staff include those that build the commercial recreation?
I think so, yeah. And I think, I mean, if you don't accept that proposition, I think you've got to look at the effects of it. What is the effect that is different from accommodating the construction staff building those facilities as compared with the staff who would be working at site once it's operational?
One other question for me, and that relates to your discussion of infrastructure issues. Before I go there, just following up on the Commissioner's point, saying you're relying on the fact that the zone already provides for staff accommodation. Where does the potential for off-site staff accommodation, somebody else's staff living on the Corbridge site, if you're relying on the fact on the provision already in the rules for staff accommodation? I understand your argument about that includes construction staff, but on the face of it, it clearly doesn't include someone else's staff.
Mm. Well, that's right, and we haven't sought that as a permitted activity.
Are you seeking it as a non-compliant activity?
Yes.
And what is it currently in the notified plan?
Well, I think it would default to non-compliant, probably.
Is someone else's staff, doesn't that come with it? Wouldn't that be within the general prohibition on residential activity?
I think that'd be right, yes.
So it would be prohibited.
Is it prohibited?
In which zone? In the rural zone?
In the RV zone. Well, I suppose maybe that's the answer. It's not prohibited in the rural zone. So between the rural zone and the RV zone, there is a consenting, discouraged, but there is a consenting pathway. That might be the answer to my question. I might have answered it myself.
Yeah, I mean, residential activity in the notified provisions of the RVZ was non-compliant. So it essentially remains the same.
So go back to where I was going to go. Infrastructure.
Yes.
Now, put to one side the potential that we need to discuss, Mr. Botting, about doing it all yourself. Talking about the option the council doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading paragraph 57.
Yes.
And you're saying, well, the fact that it's not within the council's LTP is not fatal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to reconcile that in my mind with cases like Ford that say that, in effect, that if development infrastructure to allow development to proceed
proceed is not provided for by council. That is a matter going to sustainable management. In essence, it's not sustainable management to provide for things that where the infrastructure isn't in contemplation, at least, where it isn't planned for. So what? So how do you reconcile that? You're making the submission that it's not fatal, and I understood that the case has said it was.
Well, I suppose it goes back to my point in the earlier paragraph, paragraph 56, that you end up between a rock and a hard place if you can't get a piece of land rezoned because council haven't contemplated the infrastructure. But as a general rule, council also don't contemplate the infrastructure until they know that they've got some land that they need to be providing it for. So in our case, we think that there are more than adequate solutions available to deal with it on site, if that's what's necessary. If council decide that they want to service it, then there are processes available on reasonable timelines to do that, and that can be done. So I think if you, as an overarching proposition, conclude that rezoning the site is the most appropriate outcome, then the infrastructure question is merely a problem that can be solved.
I suppose my reaction is that's a merits answer. I understand the argument, but you haven't told me why the cases don't apply. Like I maybe like it's a while since I read those cases.
Yeah,
where it may be a stretch. I may paraphrase them incorrectly, but as I say,
yeah.
You haven't told me.
No, and I have to confess it's a while since I've read those cases too. So perhaps it's something I could revert to you on.
All right. Like I think that's the more efficient. If it's not clear in your mind, I don't expect you to remember all however many thousand environmental cases there are, because I certainly don't.
No.
So can we leave it on the basis that you might file a memorandum before the end of next week?
Yes, sure.
And tell me that specific, to address that specific question.
Mm-hmm.
My recollection is that the cases, including but not limited to Forward, is it Forward or Forward?
Mm.
I can't remember. At the very least, cast doubt on the proposition that not being identified in the LTP is not fatal. First of all, do they actually say that? And if they do say that, do you maintain the proposition? And if so, why?
Might have something to do with whether they're within urban growth boundaries or something like that, perhaps. But yeah, I'll come back to you on it.
Yeah, a lot of cases are about roads, about road upgrades, as opposed to. But I think Four Wheel was about wastewater.
Certainly.
Any other questions from Azuba?
Yeah, thank you.
I think we're ready to hear. Yeah, you're going to call Mr. Watkins first?
Yes.
Thank you. Good morning. From my understanding, you'll just be asking questions as such as opposed to me giving a presentation on my evidence?
Well, happy to go straight to questions. First question I have is who is Corbridge Estates Partnership? I know Mr. Marshall has a driving role, but is this his baby, or is this a partnership?
It's a limited partnership of a number of individuals or entities, of which Mr. Marshall and one other are majority shareholders.
Is it a secret who the other is? Like, I don't know. I don't want to know everybody is, but if there are two...
Lloyd Ferguson is the other.
Who's that, sir?
Lloyd Ferguson.
Thank you. Talk to Mr. Van Brandenburg about this as well. How many golf courses can the Queenstown Lakes, elite golf courses, can the Queenstown Lakes area stand and remain a viable entity?
I guess viability comes down to supply and demand. There's 14 marquee golf courses in New Zealand, of which three are currently located in the Queenstown Lakes district. As far as golf goes, it's not too dissimilar to mountain biking. In fact, that people like more tracks. Mm-hmm. So people who play golf like to play different golf courses. So we believe that the Corbridge proposal would be complementary to the current marquee courses that are here, which is Jack's Point, Hills and Millbrook. With regard to your question as to how many is too many, I don't believe there is actually a number, because it depends on the number of people that could potentially play the courses. So, in effect, if there are more golf tourists than there are currently now, then that would be able to satisfy more golf courses.
But it is golf tourists that you're looking to
target? Well, people who play marquee golf courses inherently probably form two groups, or two main groups. One who are golf tourists, and others who can afford to play at marquee courses, so domestic tourist or domestic golfers.
But in that regard, talking about the rationale for a hotel on site, you said Wanaka has an undersupply of hotel, motel rooms relative to the size of the economy, and I understand that. But I wondered about the concept of I'll call it a resort hotel, putting aside the name of the zone, but we'll just call it a resort hotel for convenience. Seems much more about the whole concept of a resort is attract people in and keep them in and provide for their activities on the site. Is this hotel a solution to Wanaka's, as you say, shortage of hotels? Or is this aimed at a completely different market?
I guess it depends on how you define solution. In effect, as a hotel or a place of accommodation that has a certain level of, I guess, quality that is deficient in the current market. So in answer to the question of solution, yes, I believe so. There is an opportunity for people to stay in a high-quality accommodation that's only 5 minutes from the town centre, so therefore has proximal location to the Wanaka. As far as you talk about the, I guess, strategy of resorts to try and retain people and spend money on site, I'm sure that is the case. But inevitably, studies will show or have shown that people do like to investigate their surrounds, mm-hmm. and so there are flow-on effects or positive flow-on effects into local restaurants or activities, etc. So it's unlikely that someone, not unlikely, not all people that are accommodated in a resort will stay on site and only stay on site and not leave to go somewhere else. So there's benefit, broader benefit for the greater community.
this isn't like a Fiji golf resort where people roll in the door and they roll out when they go to their plane.
Again, depends on what type of resort and where you're talking about, but often Fiji golf resorts are located in islands that are off the main coast, so in effect you're in a captive environment. So we're in this environment, effectively there's a number of ways that you could actually leave the Corbridge environment by road, helicopter, aeroplane, etc.
At 39, you refer to the Corbridge character. What is the Corbridge character to your mind?
I think the Corbridge character is probably, you could almost swap out Central Otago or Southern Lakes character. We're talking about natural stone, wood, I guess that alpine look. So certainly not similar to a high-rise apartment in the middle of Auckland.
No questions for me,
thank you.
Yeah, it's just following, you used the word with regard to the hotel of exemplar. Can you expand on exemplar for me, please, so I can be clear?
Yeah, I think in the context of that, we're talking about a world-class facility that provides an exemplar for other types of buildings or accommodation for New Zealand. So we're looking to have something that's very aspirational, so not just another building, something that is quite special and spectacular. And that's not just the building itself, but the quality of experience and also the innovation and the technology that goes into that building as well.
And there's quite a lot, it seems to me to be a recurring theme through all the evidence, is the sustainability aspect. Now, forgive me for scepticism, but golf course, exemplar hotel, and sustainability, how do you see those? Because sustainability is often used as a bit of green paint. Can you explain how Corbridge would make that those two elements mesh together?
Well, I think it depends on how you define sustainability, but often it's considered to be ecological balance, minimal disruption, and wise use of resource. So I think if we take consideration of the golf course, Greg Norman Golf Design, who we've discussed the course with, have a very strong minimal disruption philosophy. They also have a consideration around water use and reuse and recycling and minimisation of water use. So what I'm saying is that you can actually design golf courses and operate them in a way which is, for want of a better word, sustainable, or at least more sustainable than other practices. With regard to the buildings themselves and the whole development, we've been looking at I guess, different types of solutions for generation of power, like solar, etc. We're looking at our own nurseries to grow particular plants that could be utilised in the development. So, yes, you're right when you talk about sustainability as an oft-used word, but we treat it quite seriously, and it's one of our fundamental principles of design.
And so you used logical balance, wise use of resources, and there was a third one I forgot, I didn't get a chance.
Minimal disruption.
Thank you.
What was the first one? Sorry.
Logical balance.
Ecological balance.
Ecological balance.
Yes.
I know this is probably not entirely relevant, but how do golf courses move away from massive use of fertilisers these days?
Good point.
And pesticides.
Yes, so, I mean, there are organic pesticides that can be used, similarly with fertilisers as well. There's potential to use organic matter as opposed to chemical fertilisers. So again, it's no different to organic orchards or farming. In a sense, you can treat a golf course in a similar manner. Or have
people doing that?
Correct. Yes, there are.
I mean, is that a growing trend?
Yes, I think. Well, the thing is Commissioner McLeod pointed out, a lot of people sort of use the word sustainable, but not necessarily everyone lives up to that. So the reality is that you have to walk the talk, and if you're going to state that you have a certain sort of type of development or course, then the expectation is that you would actually have land use practices that equate to that.
Yes, I've been to golf course resorts where the water hazards double as wastewater treatment plants. That's not somewhere where you wander in to retrieve your ball.
I mean, there are also golf courses where the water in the water features is now slimy and green.
Yeah.
And just, can I touch on the residential versus visitor component?
Sure.
And drift into, there's a lot of evidence that seems to be suggesting that this ain't going to fly unless we get to sell some real estate. And again, scepticism leaping to the floor, that was probably the same argument that was suggested with a Millbrook concept. And I didn't like the Millbrook analogy because I don't think the two compare in my mind, but I just need to be clear that we're not going to end up in 20 years' time, whatever period it is, with Corbridge becoming real estate.
Yes, so the financial, the main reasons for having residential offerings is a financial one. In the sense that there is a phased approach to the development of Corbridge. You would build the course first, so in effect you need seed capital for that. Then you would look to sell sections, a minimal number of sections, fairway sections, but at a premium rate. And we've been looking to integrate memberships of golf with the sale of sections, called foundation memberships. It's not uncommon around marquee courses around the world to tie in kind of a suite of product for initial members. So the reason to have a small number of residential lots is to effectively generate some cash reserves to then effectively fund the development of the visitor accommodation, which is the ultimate goal, because the visitor accommodation is where the generation of revenue will continue in the medium to long term. So that's the strategy around the residential.
So what's the bookend? I understand your strategy.
Yeah. So at the moment, I think in our structure plan, we've suggested 150 lots as a percentage of, I guess, the total number of buildings that could be built with regards to this. It makes about 10 to 15% of the overall. So the rest would be visitor accommodation.
150 residential lots.
Oh, sorry, there's
35
residential lots within 150 fairway lots.
I mean, yeah. Irving's told us not to worry about the future, but you have 150 residential-style visitor accommodation units, of which only 35 can be used as residential. Mm. What does that mean?
Well, it means the remaining ones can be used for visitor accommodation.
Or must be.
Yes.
Yeah. Or does that mean you can have 180 days at this one and 180 days at this one?
Well, there is some provision for that.
And then amongst all 150, as long as no more than 35 are being used at any one time?
Yes, well, I mean, there is a possibility for that, but the great likelihood is visitor accommodation. So
and other ones dedicated to residential and
correct.
Sold as such.
Correct.
Just to touch on marquee course, I note there's a couple of marquee, there's three in Queenstown. There's a gate on most of them. Am I going to be excluded and destined to play at Terrace for the rest of my days? Or is there envisaged that everyone's going to, that there'll be locals involved in this?
As far as a membership model or a commercial model for the golf course is concerned, we haven't come to a sort of a firm or final.
You're keeping out the referee.
I guess like any environment, whether it's a gym or otherwise, there is membership requirements. Whether that that means that, that locals will not will be playing. I fundamentally believe that locals will be playing at the course.
And just on the last question is with regard to the, because you've got a lot to do with Nautilus Modular.
Correct.
I believe, and the, can you give me, because leaving aside the fundamental question of is this permitted, right, and it's a bit like if you looked at this as a Rolls Royce, but potentially knowing Mr. Marshall, maybe a McLaren might be a better fit, and it's a beautiful McLaren. Is it parked in the right spot? You know, is that's the question that, that comes to, is this the right fit? To, but what's your vision of the Nautilus Modular and workers accommodation to provide for the build initially and then longer term for the numbers of staff that are going to be required?
So for clarity, the worker accommodation model that's been proposed is that the buildings themselves will be supplied by a company called Nautilus Modular, of which I'm general manager of. And these are an innovative modular building product that's unique in New Zealand and hopefully the world. So the vision, I guess, is we've put together or created a community-based model for which we would like to implement it at Corbridge and basically apply that to the workers' accommodation precinct. So I guess the vision that we have, and Mr. Falconer will talk to this more after me, is around creating a community-type environment. Not buildings stacked side by side by side, but a lot of green spaces, a lot of communal spaces, and something that we think will be, again, a future exemplar for other developments for worker accommodation. So we have no desire to create anything like the previous generations did with dam building, where there's single men's quarters side by side. Mm. This is something that we believe is not just a practical thing with regards to worker accommodation, but an opportunity to show others how you can provide worker accommodation in a quality and livable environment.
And with regard to the workers' accommodation and like the Public Works Act, well, state houses that were built then were actually still they're quite sought after now. So
they were workers' accommodation.
What?
They were workers' accommodation.
They were workers' accommodation. And, but the discussion, I mean, how, I get the point about workers providing accommodation for workers, but how do you propose, like, say construction, I'm working on the site, my partner's not, so there's a tension there, my partner's working at Edgewater, teaching in the school, there's a tension there, isn't there, on-site, off-site?
Well, I think it comes down to what we consider to be fair and practical with regards to relationships and people working together and living together. So in the sense of, is it appropriate for a person who has a family to who works at Corbridge, who is accommodated at Corbridge, not to be accommodated with his or her family?
Well, when I was going to ask the planners about how they're going to define children, partners, someone who retires, someone who's temporarily unemployed, but you know maybe seasonally employed, but not all the time. I mean, do they have to come and go? I mean, I guess this is a question that you need to answer. Someone needs to answer. What does that mean, workers' accommodation?
Agreed. I mean, again, setting aside the principle, which we'll get into, I was just more trying to work because I think you know I've had a discussion about I grew up in the north of Scotland and workers' accommodation was pretty much an understanding that you, it was one of those things that you had to provide, but it's a different experience. This is gets into the whole discussion, the rabbit hole that we end up pitching on, which is the zone versus not the zone.
Well, I guess
I'd be interested in your vision on that, as well, your thought on that.
Well, I guess the thing is, if we go back to first principles, which is practicality, if we take example of, let's say, the hotel or resort accommodation, it could be that a senior manager is attracted to work at the Corbridge Resort, and one of those elements is that they you know have to stay on site because of their role. They could then come with their family and live there. So that would be a practical expectation. It wouldn't be an expectation that the person who had the role lived at Corbridge and the rest of their family lived in town.
But then you come up, start coming up against these policies about not having mini towns developing in the rural area where the partners commute to their jobs, the children go in and out to school, they go in and out to sport, they go in and out for their shopping, and it just becomes like a little mini town in the middle of nowhere. So, and it's not remote. So, I mean, the planners will need to answer these questions. How does that all fit in the grand scheme of things?
And it's not something that we're chucking on your shoulders and saying, answer that. It's more of a highlight to everyone else behind you. Though.
Sure.
I mean, it looks very nice. It looks like a nice little community.
And that also gets into the discussion, and this is a discussion more than question, but if you then have that sort of on site, do you then look at like a small four square or
a little school or childcare or
it's all laudable, but it's just whether not laudable, that's the wrong question. It may or may not be laudable, but that's all from me, sir.
Thank you. Ms. Evan, I think that we might have a break for a cup of tea. Since you've said that you'd schedule people after breaks, does that mean that we'll hear from Mr. Marshall? Or are you going to Zoom somebody in?
Yeah, it'll either be Mr. Marshall or Mr. Lane, who is the representative from Greg Norman Golf, who's on the Gold Coast.
Gold Coast being, so quarter to 9 in the morning?
Yes. He's lined up and ready to go.
Quarter to 8. Over to you.
Well,
if it's Mr. Lane, we'll sort it out with the cat.
Yes.
And we'll start at 11.